This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
Okay. You ever have one of those days, though? Hold on, Doc. You ever have one of those days where, I know it's Sunday, so we're not thinking about work, but you have one of those days where you just show up and you really don't know what your day's going to be like. You don't know what's going on in your day. I feel like that right now because as you and I both arrived at the station, you said, well, not much going on, so let's talk about politics. What are we talking about today, Doc? Mike, fill me in,
Mike,
buddy.
Mike, there's an election in 2 days. What do you think we're going to talk
okay,
about?
Okay, good. Okay. Let's talk about
that. But what we're not going to do, I tell you what I think has been beaten to death, that we're going to try to avoid here. We may not be able to get completely out of it. But we're going to try to avoid is the, oh, what's going to happen in 2 days? I think at broad stroke levels, we know what's going to happen. Yes, the Senate of the United States is in play. I think most of us at this table would probably nod and say that the Republicans need six seats to take over. They're probably going to win six plus or minus two. We're going to have a narrowly divided Senate. We're going to have that the Republicans, probably a little bit in a coin flip, are in nominal control of. We're going to have a House that's run by the Republicans, and we have a Democratic president. And we're going to have, by most assessments, some level of gridlock. And that's what I wanted us to talk about. All right, where do we go from here? On the assumption that we were not absolutely astounded in 2 days. How do we get out of this? We seem to have been in a funk for several years. Nothing's happening. We've got a president with an agenda that has been stymied, a Republican Congress that has had an objective of, quote, stopping Obama, and they seem largely to have succeeded in that. The question is, where do we move from here? How do we go? How do we move forward in any level with, given that composition? We have with us two deep thinkers, Bob Robb, Republic columnist, former one-time Republican operative. Did you ever make it? Did you ever have an L? Did you ever register as a lobbyist?
Well, yes. For the early part of my career, yep. I lobbied on behalf of the Arizona and Phoenix Chambers of Commerce. It was my primary function.
Okay. So Ron Ober, Big L lobbyist, current former Democratic political operative. And we can talk about that. That's been but let's start out with the big question. As a nation, and we'll talk about this later at the state level, how do we get out of this kind of funk that we are in, where nothing seems to happen? Everybody knows people get motivated by what they're against, not what they're for. How does anybody get anything done in this environment?
Well, it won't change until the American people quit yielding, through their electoral decisions, a divided government. And I used to believe that we got divided government by accident. I'm increasingly of the mind that the American people kind of think that serves a useful purpose in keeping both parties in check.
By the way, I remember counting that up, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but we've had divided government a lot more than not over the last 30 years.
Basically, since Ronald Reagan was elected president, we have had mostly divided government. There's only been, I think, about 4 years in which both branches of Congress and the presidency were held by the same political party. And I do believe that the American people don't trust either party, and so they unconsciously or consciously choose divided government to keep each side keeping the other in check. Until they decide differently, we're not going to see anything other than government by herks and jerks. You have to pass a budget, and that's about the only thing government needs to do. Now, I will say there will be an external shock to the system that will occur sometime in 2016 that may change things. The Social Security Disability Trust Fund is currently projected to go insolvent sometime in 2016. At that point in time, the day of reckoning for the entitlement state and its affordability can no longer be ducked. Inaction would mean that disability payments are cut by about 20%. So the issue of the unaffordability of our entitlement state will be present before Congress and will not be able to be ducked. That may be the kind of external shock that either causes the members of the two political parties in Washington to work cooperatively in a way that they haven't, or cause the American people in 2016 to decide to tilt one way or the other decisively so that one of the parties have the political clout to actually implement what they stand for.
Ron, the parties working cooperatively, do you see any way that's on the horizon?
Well, not until one of two things happen, and I agree with Bob. One of two things have to happen. Either the politicians have to change or the people have to change politics. And until we shine a light on what's really going on, it's not going to happen. We've gone from when Bob and I first got involved back in the 70s, a United States Senate that had over 70 moderates, to today probably less than a handful, if not zero. Harry Reid, when he first came to the Senate, was a moderate. He's not anymore. A lot of people who are moderates aren't. And I think it's important, and the media has some responsibility, organizations, everybody's got a responsibility, put a light on what these people do. When I first went back to Washington in 1977, when I would come back and forth with Senator DeConcini, we flew there on Sunday, we worked all week, we came back on Friday night, and we worked in the state for 2 days. The families lived back there. People got to know each other. They had dinner together. Their kids went to school together. They played soccer together, football together. They went to PTA meetings. And they knew each other as people. Today they go back there. They're a Tuesday to Thursday club. The families live at home. And let me tell you what they do when they go back there. If you're in the House of Representatives, you spend your day as follows. You go back there, you do some committee meetings. You go to the floor for a little bit. Sometimes you have some procedural votes. You don't do a lot because there's not much being voted on. And you spend half your day meeting with constituents or walking across the street and being humiliated, sitting in a cubbyhole with an aide, with a cell phone, calling people back in your state and all over the country raising money. And then you come home and spend 4 days and you literally raise money and campaign. So when people figure out that what we're really paying our representatives to do is to raise money, win elections, beat the opponent instead of doing the people's business, that's when we'll wake up.
And we need to, and I think we all do, and that's why we've called people from both sides of the aisle here today in the think tank. We are talking about the divide in our electoral politics, and will it ever be closed? More coming up right here on the think tank, KTAR News.
You're listening to the think tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
Okay, we're back with Bob Robb, political columnist for the Arizona Republic, and Ron Ober, lobbyist and former Democratic operative. We've talked about national level, and the question I guess I asked there, and I didn't hear much of an answer to, maybe because there isn't one, is how do we get out of this? I heard when people start to pay more attention to what's happening, you know, we're looking at our elections, and the commercials that we see seem to me to be entirely directed at the sort of the residual 5% who are not instinctively voting one way or the other. And by and large, those are folks of the least level of knowledge. Is there any prospect, you think, for greater public involvement or awareness if that's what it takes?
You know, I'm not 100% sure, but, you know, going back to your question real quick about some specifics, one of the things that could potentially be done is looking at the rules of how Congress operates. The United States Senate for years has operated in order to break cloture, which means to bring something to a vote, you have to have, unless you have unanimous consent, no one objecting, you have to have 60 votes to bring most things to a vote in the United States Senate. In the old days, when in the 70s, there were over 67 Democrats. And it was hard to get cloture because it was hard to get 60 people, even of the same party, to agree to bring something up or agree philosophically to something. It's possible that we may need to look at those rules. That's dangerous to do, that maybe you need to operate more like the House, where you only need 50 plus one vote to pass something. It used to be that the Senate was the stopgap for things that used to come out of the House that might not be really good public policy. But today it's really hard to move anything. If anything, you might move a package. A good example of that is just recently before the Senate took off for the summer recess, or they were voting on the Iron Dome funding to continue funding for that. The first time it went down. And it went down because nothing could pass the United States Senate, so they Christmas treed that bill. Democrats put on their stuff, Republicans put on their stuff, and then they couldn't get enough votes to pass it. So they had to actually keep them an extra day. Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid kept them an extra day, and they had to strip everything off. And then finally, I think it passed 99 to nothing. But they can't get anything done with the current rules. That's part of the problem with the gridlock.
Your ex-boss, Senator Dennis DeConcini, was in here, and he said that when they took away earmarks as a incentive to get votes, that's one of the things that contributed to a lack of the ability to get anything done.
Well, that's part of it, because what they were able to do with earmarks is that's how
you buy votes.
They were able to put together coalitions to get things done. Absolutely.
Which drives Mike Russell crazy.
It drives me absolutely insane, because it got out of control. I think there was a time. I think there are a lot of things in this country that there was a time for it, and it served its purpose. It's time to move on.
But the Senate does seem to be the place where bills go to die right now.
Absolutely. I mean, the House passes lots of bills. They can pass bills one at a time, and they get them over to the Senate. And most bills can't move. There's a lot of killing of bills, because if my bill doesn't get a vote, your bill doesn't get a vote. And that's what happens a lot.
And we seem to have had a lot of cases where people tried to put together a grand bargain where, well, we'll give this side will get this and this side will get this. But they never seem to get pulled off these days.
Function of the Senate isn't entirely a matter of the rules. I happen to think that the filibuster is extra constitutional, if not unconstitutional. The Constitution specifies the circumstances under which an extraordinary majority vote in Congress was to be required by the founders, and to me, by implication, that means everything else is supposed to pass by a simple majority. So I would be in favor of getting the filibuster, getting rid of the filibuster entirely, and I believe that it's extra constitutional. But in reality, Harry Reid has shut down any deliberation and debate in the U.S. Senate, and it's not just because of the rules. It's because he's trying to manage the politics to protect vulnerable Democrats and won't even allow Democrats to get amendments voted on the floor of what throughout history has been known as the world's greatest deliberative body. And that's now becoming an issue. Mary Landrieu in Louisiana is being asked, well, what good is it to be the Senate Energy Committee Chairman if you can't get Harry Reid to schedule a vote on the Keystone Pipeline that you say you're in favor of? Mark Bejek in Alaska is facing the same issue in his state. Harry Reid has shut the joint down. There are things that could be voted on in past, but in reality, the grand bargain wasn't achievable because the divide between the two parties is too big to be bridged. And until one side or the other is empowered by the American people with proportionate power to win that divide, I don't see anything changing. And frankly, government by budget resolution isn't good, but it's better than completely shutting down the government.
And I got to tell you, and I talked to a lot of people who work for the federal government, and what they hate about that is you're midway through a budget year and you don't know what you have to spend for the year. Talk about bad enough you only get it at the beginning of the year. Now you're halfway through the year. So if somebody decides to cut something by 5%, it's not a 5% cut. It's at least 10, and it's with no planning, no forethought, and that's when you get forced to make really bad decisions.
I think rather than waiting till the end to pass a continuing resolution, What Congress ought to do is to pass the continuing resolution at the beginning, along with an increase with the debt limit to accommodate it. That doesn't keep the appropriation committees from operating.
It just tells the entire government what they have to work with in lieu of a decision.
In lieu of a decision. So rather than wait until we're facing the precipice of a government shutdown, just do that to begin with, and then see if you can agree on something different.
What that cuts off is the fear. It cuts off the panic, and if that panic is shut off, that shuts off the flow of money to each of these politicians and let's just be honest with you, their coffers.
But what you're really talking about though is they're being derelict in their jobs. I mean, they're there to pass a budget. And they've passed maybe three in the past 20 years. I mean, they need to do their job.
And of course, but we have two sides there with dramatically different visions of what that budget ought to look like.
But in the past, they've been able to get together and do something about that. And, you know, it's important that we send people there and they start doing their jobs. Continuing resolutions are cop-outs. And the debt ceiling in the old days, 99 to nothing. I mean, we're going to meet our obligations. We're going to pay our bills. Today, we want to legislate on continuing resolutions. And part of the reason is because they can't legislate on anything else.
The craziest thing of all, I think, was the government shutdown. When we sent people home because we couldn't agree on a budget. And then on the back end, so the conservatives are happy about that, we sent people home. But then they come back in and they retroactively pay everybody for all the time when they did not work. Worst of all possible outcomes, I think.
Well, yeah, and we're going to get to more of those outcomes when we come back here. We have both sides of the political aisle represented. Can we bridge the gap? We're talking about electoral politics right here on The Think Tank, KTR News.
You're listening to The Think Tank on The Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're back with Ron Ober, lobbyist, former Democratic operative, Robert Robb, columnist for the Arizona Republic, and we've been talking about wither our politics at a 50,000-foot level. Statewide, in the state of Arizona, a little bit of a different situation. I think it's a safe bet the legislature, both houses, is safely Republican. Probably not a whole lot of change in the overall composition there. And I think the political tea leaves are more than likely a Republican governor. So maybe not that level of ossification. What do you think we can look forward to in the next couple of years in the state of Arizona?
Well, the state is back to drowning in red ink, and it's going to be paralyzing. It will completely consume the next governor and the next legislature for at least 2 years. And my guess is for the entire 4 years of the next governor's term. The legislature had weaned itself off of temporizing measures such as debt or accounting gimmicks or taking money from other state accounts to support general fund programs.
Basically because they ran out of stuff to take, didn't they?
No, there's still stuff out there, and some of those coffers have replenished. So I think you're going to see, since there is no appetite to increase taxes to resolve the deficit, I think you're going to see a return to looking at those temporizing measures, which simply postpones the day of reckoning.
Temporizing measures, that for the layman, I think that means stealing money from an assortment of funds that exist that the state owns.
But it also includes delaying accounting for the payment of something to a future year while you allow the spending of it to continue to occur in this year.
Which comes back to haunt you over the long haul.
It does. It all comes back to bite you in the long haul. Doug Ducey's hope, and I think probably an excessively optimistic hope, to put it mildly, is that he can reform the way government does things to reduce that deficit to a more manageable size. And then you do have about $450 million in a rainy day fund that
one
you
time.
Can apply to it one time and hope that the economy start generating its historic average of 6 to 8% revenue growth rather than what we've currently had, which is about 3 to 4% revenue
growth.
6 to 8%.
That's a mind-bogglingly optimistic, I think, estimate of what we're going to get.
I'm not sure we're going to have enough money in other accounts or a gimmick that we can use to take care of all our obligations. Hopefully the economy will recover. But what we really need is a new governor who's going to be very transparent with the people of Arizona. Tell them where we are. Tell them what our situation is, because I think people, if they really understand where we're at and if they know what we need, they may answer the call, if a call be made. I'm here advocating a new tax. But if you look at cities and other things, when you've had initiatives where you've asked people to participate, or even at a county or state level, the more specific you are, the specific you are into it, they'll be on team.
I observed specific asked to high priority items.
Exactly.
And something in it that somebody can grab on and see that's waste. I wanted to ask you, Ron, in particular, I look at this and I see some structural issues to the way we govern that are responsible for this. The voters passed something that at the time seemed to make sense. Well, no new tax increases without a supermajority. And we like less taxes, so that seemed reasonable, so we passed that. Then in good times, when we were getting that 6 to 8% pump a year, it was relatively easy to cut all sorts of taxes. So now we're taxed at a much lower rate. Then bad times come, we're not getting that, we're really not getting that, our revenues are sinking, and almost we require a two-thirds vote in order to pass an increase, even to put it back where it was, and you can't do that because you can never get a two-thirds vote for a tax increase for anything. So we cut taxes in good times, but we can't raise them in bad times. We're stuck with the lower rates, and we seem to be unable to do anything. Does that seem to you like that's where we're at?
It's a problem. And when you're talking about, and, you know, everyone aspires to what Doug Ducey wants to do, which is to lower our personal income tax. But to even talk about it and try to think about doing it now when we're in the economic times that we are, it's pretty unrealistic. It sounds good, but it's pretty unrealistic.
That sounds like 1992 Bill Clinton
right.
was in favor of a tax cut. Until right after the election, he says, oops, no, what we need is a tax increase.
Exactly. Well, Governor Brewer had to go back to the people for a temporary sales tax, but she did it in a very transparent way, went to the people, explained to them what needed to be done, and worked really hard, and people bought into a temporary sales tax.
But we were in a really,
really
extreme
bad.
Situation.
No, but I think he's onto something, that it was transparent, and this is what you're saying. Talk to us like grown-ups, and we'll probably come along for the ride.
Exactly. City of Peoria, they were in line to get transportation funds from the county transportation tax. They didn't want to wait as long. So what they did is they went out and did their own tax. But they did a real public involvement process. They talked to their voters. They didn't advocate, but they explained their situation. And people bought in that some of the roads that they needed to get people across their community so that they would spend money in their community and commutes and things like that. People bought into that because they were explained exactly what was needed. And I think people of Arizona, we're a conservative state, but our people are open to support initiatives when they understand them, when they're a priority, and when they see the need. And that's what we need to explain and talk to people about.
Bob, can you see a Governor Ducey ever going to the state and saying we need to increase taxes on anything?
Well, he has spoken in favor of broadening bases and lowering rates. So there would be some things in the course of that that would see higher taxes.
Well, the question is whether it nets out higher.
In terms of a net tax increase, certainly not in the first year. And the Republican legislature has demonstrated time and time again that they prefer resorting to temporizing measures, even ones that they find distasteful, such as debt. I mean, the state borrowed $2 billion to get through the aftermath of the Great Recession than to increase taxes and create a more stable environment on a going forward basis. So unfortunately, I've advocated a tax increase, so I've crossed that Rubicon.
Okay, you're not personally. Getting elected to the legislature.
Yes, but the only way that I see it politically in the cards is through an initiative, and an initiative can't go on the ballot till 2016. It won't go into effect to 2017. That's three budgets down the line. So I frankly don't see how we get through the next two budget years.
Especially the second year, it seems. The first year, we've got the rainy day fund to hit up. It seems to me it gets dicey after that.
It does, but the with the current court decision in terms of what the state owes in inflation funding for schools, there's a deficit even if you applied all of the rainy day fund to this year's deficit. You still have about $100 billion that you got to do something about. Now, you can maneuver $100 million in a $9.2 billion budget. But you don't have an answer after that. So to me, either the only way I actually see out of it is for the legislature to win its appeal of that decision, or for there to be a settlement that phases in what the schools say is owed on a more digestible schedule than do it now, even though you ain't got the money to pay it.
Well, the schools have certainly been flexible so far. I mean, they agreed to waive the $1.5 billion in arrears payment. That's a pretty big initial concession.
Yeah, I think the next step, and this may be something that Ducey would be willing to do, is for the state to make a counteroffer. Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm darn sure Doc and I have some opinions on this, and we're going to discuss when we come back right here in the Think Tank on KTAR News.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
All right. Can we divide? Can we divide?
We can divide.
Heck yeah, we can divide. We're the best at it right here in the Think Tank. I kid. Can we bridge this gap between the R's and the D's of the country? Can we finally start to get the will of the people done? And off air, an interesting point was brought up that as polarized as we see our government, it's kind of mirroring the electorate.
It does. We have red states. We have blue states. Yeah. We have red and blue districts. And we talk about these elections as if huge changes have been made. Less than 10% of people, probably less than 5%, are switching their vote between 2012 and 2014. The likely Republican are doing a little better this time for a couple of reasons. Number one, they're playing on home turf. Most of the pickups, and they will make pickups in the Senate, are Democratic senators from states that Obama carried like 45% of the vote, and they're voting. And it was an anomaly that they won in the first place 6 years ago.
Well, they were riding on an Obama wave.
They were riding on this hope and change.
Yeah.
This is the class of 2008. That's the top of the wave.
Right.
By the way, so I think there's a modest likelihood, a little better than a coin flip, that the Republicans, they will make gains. Whether they take over the Senate is a little less certain, but I think it's more likely than not. But if you look out to that landscape, 2016 is the class of 2010, which was a big Republican year. Most of those seats are up in blue states, and it's the absolute reverse. So you could see the Senate going Republican this year and Democrat 2 years back, the House staying Republican, the presidency, there's an advantage on the playing field there on the Democratic side that's not insurmountable, but it's tough. So what does that say? We're a divided country, and bottom line, it looks like we're going to have divided government for almost the foreseeable future.
Sure, and I don't see that changing because of there's so many factors at play from a voter's standpoint. And what I mean by that is across the country, it's my guy's doing the good stuff. My guy's fighting the good fight. What's the incumbent reelection rate?
Oh, it's way over 90%.
Over 90%. Yeah. Because we hate government. And governor, I think their approval rating is at 17%, 13%. Congress's approval rating. Okay.
But it's those other congressmen.
It's the other guys.
Mine's a swell guy.
Yeah, it's those, exactly. And that is the problem.
Yeah, the districts themselves are also lopsided. We have 435 members of Congress. There's less than 20 seats that are genuinely contested. We're blessed in this state. Thank you, Redistricting Commission. We got three genuinely competitive seats. That absolutely.
But wait till next election. We're going to see where this gerrymandering has been taking us to whole new heights.
Well, you mean next decade?
Next decade.
You don't redo the district lines until.
Oh, okay. I apologize.
It doesn't 2020, and it doesn't take effect until 2022. So we're going to have these lines for another 6 years.
Craziness after that.
So but there's something else. Even when you don't gerrymander. Mm-hmm. We have patterns of residential self-selection that unless you set out with the number one goal being competitive districts, you don't get them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a fact of life. We residentially segregate in along lines that so correlate with our political predispositions that you really, really have to work hard to get competitive districts.
As ugly as the word segregate is, it's in our nature. It's in our American DNA. It is what we do in communities. It's what we do in workplaces. It's what we do in schools. It's what we do everywhere. Segregate ourselves.
You know,
we hang up birds of a feather. That is the cardinal law of the United States electorate.
But you know, it's actually gotten more extreme. Used to be, always has been, we segregate.
Well,
we segregate economically, okay? But we have I've seen a study of this. Over the last 20 years, we now segregate attitudinally, okay?
Yes.
So there's neighborhoods, even say in wealthy neighborhoods, there's wealthy neighborhoods with new Cadillacs and other wealthy neighborhoods with old beat up Volvos, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And those are different kind of folks who live there, okay?
Can I translate? Volvo Democrat.
Yeah, you got
Cadillac
it.
Cadillac Republican.
You got it. Guess which one has the Greenpeace sticker on it?
Volvo, yes.
You know, and this, by the way, has increased over the last 20 years. I've seen interesting studies on this. So we not only economic, yes, if you're more well-to-do, you live in a bigger house, you know, but it's also different kinds of neighborhoods with different kinds of feel to it. It's about comfort level. So the point is, even if you honestly try to, once you set things up in relatively small districts, like congressional districts, you are more likely than not going to be surrounded by people you like who think the way you do.
And I agree. And then let's add social media on top of that, where you're selecting your friends, and that is where you get the majority of your news and your world views. You're actually polarizing yourself even more so. You're segregating yourself into one ideology.
We used to get news off of three networks that were fundamentally the same, that were presenting a very bland, unopinionated version of stuff.
The good old days.
Now we got more, you know, hundreds and hundreds of channels. And what gets even worse, you see things like Google is modifying their algorithms based on what you've selected to give you more of what you like.
Exactly.
So you will increasingly, to paraphrase the old Moynihan quote, you know, you're entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts. Increasingly, you're going to be exposed to your own unique set of facts.
You are. And that's what you're going to see.
And it doesn't bode very well for the nature of our politics.
No.
And of course, the other thing about this, and I think back to this election that we're, you know, culminating, that 40%, 45% on each side made up their mind before these campaigns ever started. The 5 or 10% that haven't are the least knowledgeable. And that is why you are getting negative campaigning. You know, in our gubernatorial race, look at the stuff on he's liberal. He's lobbyist
because some with Obama
got
to put Obama
and the other thing, frankly, if you dissected this campaign, people say they want a positive campaign. DeVos run an essentially positive campaign. There is not that same parallel level of attacks, and you know,
and
he's going to lose
exactly,
and everybody's going to look at that. This is like the old ad story I've told here before. The person says, well, I don't listen to advertising, and the ad exec asks him, well, you know, what kind of toothpaste do you use? And he says, well, I use Gleam. And this will date me. It's an old story.
Yeah, exactly.
And the guy said, well, why do you use Gleam? He says, well, because I can't brush back after every meal, which was at the time the content of Gleam's advertising. So right. We say we hate negative ads. We, however, remember the message. You know what's really bad about it is when we hear a negative thing and it's from a not very credible source, in the instant we say, oh, I don't believe those folks. Over time, what happens is we forget that the source was uncredible, but we remember the message.
I would agree with that. But I think that it used to be the campaign ads, especially on television, almost inform people, hey, who's running?
Yes.
Who's in this race? And now when we have the Fox News, we have MSNBC, completely polar opposites of each other. And then we have our social media accounts where we're just hanging out with the birds that look exactly and act just like we do. We're now being told who we're voting for, not so much who's in the race.
And it was a constraining influence before you got outside money, when the candidate had to come and say, you know, I'm Josh Globotnick and I approve this message. So if it was particularly smarmy, you had to take ownership of it.
Right.
And I noticed those ads weren't. They might have been a little hard hit, but they didn't have the extreme level of smear that you see from a lot of the third party ads right now, the kind of one word epithets.
And, you know, I'm going to give a tip of the hat right now to Kyrsten Sinema. I've seen ads of her about her and not about her who she's running against.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was impressive. That's one of the very few I have seen in this entire national or local. That's surprising to me.
You know, that also tells you something else. It tells you she's pretty convinced that she's ahead.
Well, okay, there you go. I'll take that too. She's a smart cookie, that's for sure.
Yeah. So,
what's the one thing? Would it be a jar? Would it be a jar in the polling system? Would it be a jar in how campaigns are funded? What needs to change?
The one thing that I don't see happen, if more people really paid attention. That last 5% that's
going to get people to pay attention.
Yeah, that's what would change everything.
Okay.
Because if you got to the point where somebody was putting out very simplistic one word smear and people looked at that and laughed at it, then they'd stop.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we're not going to see it in 2 days.
No.
We're definitely not going to see it. But we will be here. Please, we have extended campaign coverage right here on KTAR News and KTAR.com. Doc O'Neill and I will be here along with Bruce St. James. And Jamie West will be with us as well. And we'll be bringing all of the campaign coverage live to you right here on KTAR News. Thanks for spending some time with us. Have a great week and vote!